the principle of support for the Palestinian cause, I'm sorry to say, for the Western left, is that the more deplorable the actions undertaken in the name of the Palestinian cause, the more indefensible, the more inhumane, anti-humanistic, the greater the outburst of support for that cause.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Diet Soap is a Sublation Media podcast.
Jacob Siegel is a senior editor for Tablet Magazine. He is a co-host for the Manifesto podcast, and he is the author of the essay, A Guide to Understanding the Hoax of the Century. He has also written about the Israeli-Palestine conflict and the U.S. relationship with Israel for Tablet Magazine in recent weeks, maybe in recent months. Jacob Siegel, welcome back to the Diet Soap podcast.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
Yeah, I'm glad to. Since we spoke last, we recorded a version of this conversation that for various reasons we decided to do again. And since we spoke last, there's been a ceasefire between Gaza and Israel, between Hamas and Israel. And then there's been a breakdown in that ceasefire. Overall, I guess I want to start by asking you, how do you view the conflict and its progression? And do you think that there is a path forward where this could be resolved sooner rather than later? I'll start with that.
The simplest way to explain how I view the conflict and its progression is in principally military, operational, and strategic terms, which for me includes the political component as well, because while I would depart, I think, from many of the sort of more prominent military analysts who've spoken about the conflict and have looked at Israel's approach, American military analysts in particular, and looked at Israel's approach and insisted that it's only going to be counterproductive and produce more terrorists, and that it is too brutal, too indiscriminate. I don't see it in those terms because I view the American legacy of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations over the last two decades as having been a failure. Now, I don't think they were a failure because they were insufficiently brutal, nor do I think that brutality is the measure of whether or not the IDF will be successful. But I view this in terms of a conventional military operation in a dense urban environment against an entrenched enemy force that has had a decade and a half to prepare and critically has support of the international community in some very significant ways. So, you know, in terms of what lens I view this through, I view this through the lens of the operational requirements to achieve a victory for Israel in that offensive. And I would define victory in those terms as the destruction of Hamas, as distinct from the defeat of Hamas. And the difference between those in technical terms is that defeat is an existential condition, because it actually doctrinally in the U.S. military, defeat means that you've removed the will to fight or even the will to reconstitute Hamas. Whereas destroy means essentially to incapacitate Hamas militarily, to destroy its infrastructure and leadership. I think an attempt to defeat Hamas, that is a sort of civilizational crusade, which unfortunately is sometimes the terms that you hear Israeli leaders talking about this in, would be a dismal failure and a horrible strategic miscalculation. An effort to destroy Hamas, is not necessarily a strategic failure in the same way, because it's possible. It can be done given the means that Israel has available. And so judging it by that second standard, which appears to be, if you look at the sort of more salient comments from Israeli officials, and there have been plenty of insane and bombastic and some utterly indefensible comments from Israeli officials, but if you sort of take the median line coming from the key decision makers, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, Yoav Gallant, who's leading the military, if you take the median line, it's to destroy Hamas. And I think by any objective analysis, that appears to be going better than people would have anticipated for Israel, given how treacherous and difficult an assault on a prepared urban defense is. And it is widely acknowledged to be the most treacherous and most difficult kind of warfare. So one indication of that is the standard force ratio calculus in the U.S. military for offensive operations is 3-1, meaning that to conduct an offense, to conduct an attack, you always want to have 3 times more attacking forces than there are defending forces. One reason being you want to be able to achieve firepower superiority, and another reason being that in the event of your own casualties and losses, you need to have enough redundancy in your force that you can continue the attack. Well, that ratio goes up to either 5-1 or 8-1 in the case of urban warfare. So you expect urban warfare to be extraordinarily costly for the attacking force. And, the Israeli air campaign obviously has been devastating and, in some places clearly brutal, but it has also seemed to have allowed the ground offensive to maneuver, to destroy a significant degree of the Hamas infrastructure in northern Gaza, which was, not only the tunnel infrastructure that I think people are most fixated on because it's the most novel and also the most sort of obviously military and treacherous, but, there are nodes connecting these various tunnels and other sort of weapons caches, communication nodes, et cetera. So look, the framework overall that I view this through principally is, can the stated military objective be achieved, right? Is victory possible? I would have said, I would have said in reference to the U.S. military objective to remake Afghanistan as a modern democratic society as the condition of success for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, I thought that was strictly unachievable. The American forces had defined a standard of victory that couldn't possibly be achieved, which is one of the reasons why we remained in Afghanistan for 20 years. And it's arguable that we didn't actually want to achieve victory in Afghanistan because we were quite happy. It was a lucrative condition, that stalemate. It was very good for the NGOs involved, and it was good for the government to launder money through Afghanistan. In terms of Gaza, the military objectives are achievable. You can destroy Hamas. Then the key question becomes, can you leverage the destruction of Hamas into a political settlement that will be durable and achieve a measure of peace for Israelis inside their own homeland? And again, to depart from the sort of American conventional wisdom here, General Austin about a week ago sort of warned the Israelis that you have to see the population as the center of gravity. meaning that you have to win over the Gazans. And if you don't do that, you can win a tactical success and set yourself up for a strategic defeat. This was Austin's warning to the Israelis in effect. And I mean, I think that that is an insane thing to say, given that that is precisely the logic that the U.S. applied over two decades of counterinsurgency, where we measured the success of U.S. military operations in terms of the internal conditions of Afghans and Iraqis, both in terms of, you know, the sort of what we judged to be the cultural norms that we'd been able to inculcate, and also the civil infrastructure that we had grafted on, right? Like, essentially, we judged the success in Iraq and Afghanistan by the degree to which we had converted those societies to American norms, particularly of government administration, and also with the trappings, sort of cultural norms around gender equality and other symbolically potent issues like that. And that was a total failure. So I don't think that that is the way that a smart military or smart political leadership, and it's by no means certain that Israel has either of those right now, but they have at least avoided that trap so far, I would say, and seem to be judging the success of the operation in terms of the impact that it'll have on Israeli society, not the ability to sort of win over Gazans to a two-state solution or something else that would be palatable to the leadership in the White House right now and the sort of international community.
The comparison to Afghanistan is interesting because I can't help but think about the war on terror and my own left activism back in 2001, 2002, and beyond. So in Afghanistan, would you say that it was the case that the United States destroyed the Taliban towards the outset of the war, rather than having really fully defeated the Taliban at that time?
No, but I would say that the U.S. destroyed Al-Qaeda, the so-called, you know, the Arabs, as the Taliban called them, right? All the Al-Qaeda fighters were known as the Arabs, and that was what should have constituted victory. You know, we defeated Al-Qaeda, we separated them from the Taliban, we made the Taliban want to sue for peace, essentially on terms that we had dictated through our defeat of Al-Qaeda. And then, having done all that, we couldn't face up to the possibility of victory and decided to stick around for another 15 years, which was, will go down as one of the stupidest decisions ever made. And I think reflected stupid from the position of what's in the national interest, you know, stupid as a matter of wise statesmanship, not stupid necessarily if you're a member of a kind of narrowly self-interested, extractive ruling class that represents, that sees that Afghanistan represents certain lucrative potentialities. And I think there legitimately was some of that. I don't think there were only blunders in Afghanistan. I think there was also a sense that the war could be maintained at a sort of low level indefinitely without achieving any kind of significant victory, while pursuing impossible goals that made it necessary to always remain for another 5 years in a sort of a state of indefinite nation building. But in 2004, basically, we could have declared victory and come home. We could have done that in 2004 in Afghanistan and created the conditions that would have established a durable peace for Americans inside their own homeland, which is what that's the definition of victory that is feasible, that's legible to Americans and their leaders, right? Because the what we pursued in Afghanistan was inscrutable even to us. And you can see this in the Afghan Afghanistan papers that the Washington Post put out, which is, you know, it's an extensive record of the internal after action reviews and audits of senior military leaders, where they're acknowledging one after another, not simply that we're lying about what we're achieving in Afghanistan, though they do acknowledge that, that the progress reports are entirely fraudulent. They're also acknowledging we don't know what we're doing there. We don't understand Afghan society. We don't understand the various players in this fractious civil war that we've now appointed ourselves kingmaker over. And having, you know, been in Afghanistan as a Army intelligence officer in 2012, I can tell you I didn't understand. Nobody around me understood. And yet we had made it so that the criteria for success for the American military in Afghanistan was the transformation of the internal conditions of Afghanistan, something, again, we didn't even understand. And yet we had made it so that accomplishing that sort of transformative project was the only way that American soldiers could ever come home, and which is why it was right to leave. And it was right when Trump proposed it initially, and he was sabotaged by the national security state and Democratic Party officials who planted the Russian bounty story in the press to prevent him from signing the peace deal that he had been working on and pulling U.S. forces out of Afghanistan. And it was right when Biden did it, even if it was chaotic and unnecessarily chaotic, I would argue, and in a sort of unnecessary humiliation that led to the deaths of many U.S. soldiers when it didn't have to. It was still right to end the war, because not only was it accomplishing nothing and not vital to U.S. national security interests, the leadership of the United States had long ago abandoned even the principle of decisive victory. And you can see this in the statements from both Bush administration officials, Bush himself, Rumsfeld, and from Obama, who, you know, sort of famously says, like, the idea that we're going to get a victory in Afghanistan like the one we got in Japan is a sort of relic of obsolete thinking, right? Like, that's how old wars worked. But now we're in this era of postmodern war and counterinsurgency. And so we should all just get used to the idea that warfare is this sort of interminable state of affairs that goes on forever, where we never have any clear national security interests. There's no vital national interest at stake. We never know exactly what we're accomplishing. And the only way to judge whether we've won or lost is by what happens to other people in their country, what happens to Afghans in Afghanistan. But really, as I'm saying, that the only good standard of victory, the only true standard of victory for America, for an American war, is what happens to Americans in their homeland.
When I was a peace activist around 2002, before and during the initial invasion of Afghanistan, I would stand on a few facts. I mean, I certainly didn't know everything that I was talking about, but one of the things that I always made a big point out of was two things. One, Al-Qaeda was not primarily an Afghan organization. It came out of the funding for it, and a lot of the support for it came out of Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden was a Saudi royal. And two, the Taliban had offered to extradite bin Laden in advance of the bombings in order to try to stave off the bombardment and invasion of Afghanistan. So my question for you is, if we had taken up the extradition of bin Laden and sought a non-military approach, could Al-Qaeda been destroyed in a non-military way, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think you're right. The first point you made is much stronger than the second point. So the connection to the Saudi kingdom was essential to understand what victory would require. And in a moment, I can explain why I think that brings us back to the uncertainty of an Israeli victory despite the military success so far. So the fact that the key funding for Al-Qaeda and the sort of network of support for Al-Qaeda had come through this Saudi network, propagation of Wahhabism that was being led by the Saudi government, was essential in something that the U.S. government clearly tried to cover up because of our relations. Covered up for decades, by the way, you know, the sort of full extent of some of this. Bizarrely, we also covered up the Iranian and Iraqi involvement in some ways in as state sponsors of terrorism, even while we invented other sort of pretexts for war. But
Iraq didn't support Al-Qaeda particularly, right? There was not a lot of connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, but for other terrorist organizations, maybe, or that, yeah. Al-Qaeda as well.
Yes. Some with Al-Qaeda, though not the most attention getting examples of this that were generated in the lead up to war were all overstated, wrong, cooked in some essential way. But I don't think you could destroy Al-Qaeda without an invasion, certainly not through the deal that the Taliban offered that I don't think was actually a convincing deal or one that that could have actually been executed on. But the fundamental point, I think, especially in relation to this, and obviously, you know, Hamas didn't, there's no comparable offer from Hamas, though in this case, the sort of comparable offer would have needed to have come from Qatar or from Iran for that matter, right? In the sense that if the Taliban was the protector of Al-Qaeda and it was the Taliban who offered to give up bin Laden, then the protector and sponsor of Hamas is Iran principally in a more immediate sense, Qatar, and neither of them made any kind of offer like that. Despite the U.S. having considerably more influence over those two countries than it had over the Taliban in 2001. Mm-hmm. The fundamental point, the sort of principle of modern warfare, and this is where I think, again, like it is painful for me to hear American leaders preaching to the world and to Israel about learning the lessons of 9/11, because every time they open their mouths, they make clear that they learned nothing from 9/11, that they took all the wrong lessons. So, you know, when Biden or Austin warns Israel not to repeat America's mistakes, it sort of sounds good. In theory, it's good, except Biden and Austin don't know what those mistakes are, because in the next sentence, the counsel that they provide, essentially fight counterinsurgency, is the same, is saying to Israel, do exactly what we did, just better, just make it work this time, right? So they still are attached to the principle and the idea of counterinsurgency. Somehow they just think that, I guess, having screwed it up for two decades, they're in a position to tell another country what the right way to do it looks like. One of the key lessons I took from the failures of U.S. policy in the aftermath of 9/11. As I said, a moment ago, one of them was you have to have a achievable definition of victory and you have to know what victory is, right? So the U.S. leadership had actually systematically discredited the very notion of victory, had said victory no longer applies in modern wars. And then when there was a sort of lip service paid to victory, it was defined in these nebulous terms of nation building and transformation. So you have to have a clear sense of what victory is that is achievable and that relates to your enemy, not to some neutral third party force. Secondarily, you have to understand that there is no such thing as a non-state aligned terrorist actor. That the real power of terrorist organizations, the real power in asymmetric warfare, is always reliant to a considerable extent on state backing and state sponsorship. The real power. We may not like this to be the case. It's an anti-romantic way of looking at things, but it's what experience has shown me to be the truth, is that the real power is always the state power, that that's the sort of the end all be all of where, the power in these conflicts lies and where the sort of determinative factor is. So Saudi Arabia was part of that equation in Afghanistan. I would argue that Pakistan was also part of that equation. And we were very, the U.S. through successive administrations was very confused in our approach to Pakistan. We were strong-arming them, sort of, we didn't know how to deal with the Pakistani political leadership. We had a confused approach. And so it was ultimately self-defeating, our approach. It didn't, in some ways, it actually entrenched both Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban. You know, there's a distinction between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban, even though they're connected, and entrenched the Pakistani Taliban more deeply into the sort of security framework of the state in Pakistan. But nevertheless, that was ultimately the key factor. Those were ultimately key factors, the state backing. In the context of Israel, what you have now is, for the past 15 years since Hamas took over Gaza in 2007, you've had a series of international sponsors that have propped up Hamas, that have allowed it to develop this very extensive underground tunnel network with international aid. And, there's a tendency sometimes among left-wing critics of Israel to want to sort of have it both ways, in the sense of simultaneously celebrating Hamas as a resistance group and also declaring it the abject victim of sort of unremitting Israeli aggression. I think if you can resist that and try to look at this soberly, you'll see that there were deliberate decisions made by Hamas leadership over 15 years to spend on certain things, not spend on others, invest in certain ideas of the future and not invest in others. And some of that was undertaken, as various Hamas officials have said explicitly, with the full backing of the international community, in the sense that money brought into Gaza was diverted from humanitarian purposes to military purposes. And so the backing of both international bodies and state sponsors, including Israel, right, critically, it is true, though not in precisely the way that it's sometimes been framed, but it is true that the Netanyahu government in particular invested in Hamas, both for sort of cynical reasons to try and split the Palestinian political leadership and preempt a unified bloc that would have more negotiating leverage, and also for what I would call deluded reasons, that they seem to have bought into the idea that the Hamas leadership was moderating, could be incentivized through economic offers, increased work permits in Israel, increased aid. You know, it was Netanyahu. And Netanyahu wasn't the only one. There were also center-left Israeli leaders who continued the policy, but made the decision to allow aid money into Gaza after having blocked it initially. So what you see in all of these cases is that the strength of Hamas as a military force, the continued investment by Hamas in military opposition to Israel, and the attempt to create through military strength a political settlement that would favor it in the long run. Because I don't think that Hamas believes that it could overrun Israel militarily. I think Hamas believed that if it was strong enough to carry out an attack like this, it could force a more favorable political settlement for itself. But all of that depended on state backing at every step. And so the logical conclusion of that then is that even if you destroy Hamas inside of Gaza, to actually attain victory in a political settlement requires that you fundamentally change the framework of international and state backing for whatever political entity assumes power in Gaza after Hamas. And that'll be much more difficult to accomplish than destroying the Hamas tunnel infrastructure.
Again, to go back to Al-Qaeda, at the time, I recall reading a number of articles about how to combat terrorism in particular. And in the case of Hamas, it is very different. One of the key points that would be made by what I, in retrospect, I see as sort of progressive liberal Democrats would be that and it was always focused on why does the individual terrorist decide to join a terrorist organization? That was the kind of central question, which is probably a mistake. But the idea was if you could create conditions of relative equality within a region, allow people to feel like they were integrated into their society, and that overcome poverty was sometimes suggested, although that was always questionable to the degree to which there was a connection between poverty and terrorism. Then you could defeat terrorism rather than destroy a terrorist organization at the source, to get to the root of the problem, which was essentially uneven development on an international scale or inequality within a nation, and alienation of people. So do you think that approach to terrorism actually did inform the way in which the military approached Afghanistan? Would be my question.
Absolutely. I know that it informed it. But look, it's fascinating to me that you identify that as the liberal progressive or progressive democratic line, which I think is correct. But it's also a fair summary of the neoconservative line. There was a consensus around this. But the neoconservative policy position and the liberal interventionist policy position differed only by degree. They were united around a consensus, which was a root cause political culture consensus that terrorism was an epiphenomenon of a sort of cultural and political dysfunction. And so in the neoconservative variation, which was, you know, again, like different only by a hair's breadth from the liberal interventionist position, we needed to get rid of Arab autocracies and replace them with democracies in the Middle East. This was the original meaning of drain the swamp. Before Trump used that expression, George W. Bush used the expression in reference to the Middle East in 2001. And what he was saying was we needed to get rid of Arab dictatorships, which through their repression and through their coercive and abusive political cultures were breeding terrorism in the region. And that if only we could liberate Arab and Middle Eastern populations from this kind of repressive political culture, repressive and backward political culture, that we would effectively sort of speed up what was otherwise a natural historical progress. Because inevitably, the sort of suppressed premise there is that all human societies converge on liberal democracy. And the problem with Arab societies is that they just haven't caught up to that yet, or Arab and Muslim societies, since Afghanistan's not an Arab society. But that was both the liberal and the neoconservative consensus. And it was very much reflected in the military's approach to both Iraq and Afghanistan. In both cases, there was exactly what Austin called for Israel to practice in Gaza, that was what we did, that population-centric approach. And it wasn't just a cynical cover, or if it was, it was so effectively implemented that at the soldier level, we really believed it. You know, I can tell you as a junior enlisted guy first, and then as a junior officer after 2001, even as I passed through stages of disillusionment that happened quite early for me and, you know, progressed for the next two decades where I, you know, one thing after another, I realized wasn't adding up and our approach wasn't working, to fully give up on that sort of population-centric root causes approach took me at least a decade, probably. Even after the point where I thought I had given up on it and recognized the folly of it, the gestalt, or whatever the correct German phrase would be here, the sort of unifying cultural consensus was so deeply embedded around this idea that, you know, it was one of those things where, like, even when you thought you had seen through it, you there were still layers to peel back. And I went through that myself. And I think part of the reason why it was so hard to give up on was that there's a comforting moral dimension of it that, like, we're at war to help you ultimately, right? This is not just about sort of the narrow security interests of America. But, you know, what I have come to is the conclusion that sort of root cause, you might call it, or humanitarian or liberal interventionist approach to warfare is a disaster, leads to endless, unwinnable war. And behind its humanitarianism is actually, or its sort of veneer of humanitarianism, is actually far more pernicious, even if it is sometimes in the short term more attentive to humanitarian concerns. In the long term, it sort of erases the boundaries between politics and war. It trains people to see protracted, unwinnable warfare as a natural condition of modern society, and to view the American role in the world as addressing root cause issues in other countries.
So when you abandoned this root cause approach to understanding military interventions, or even politics in general, maybe, I mean, do you still think that the aim of a political movement should be to address root causes of disharmony within a country and maybe around the world? Or is it just the military interventions that it's wrong to approach in that way?
I'm more amenable to it in politics, in part because I think different rules apply, and I think it's healthy to view the rules of warfare and the rules of politics as being distinct. It's what the convergence of the two horrifies me. And but then even in politics, you know, I tend to think that the symptomatic outcomes or the sort of, you know, the materialist reading is more important than the root cause analysis, or maybe inseparable from it, such that if you just focus on the sort of material conditions, that you will end up addressing the root cause. Whereas if you attempt to transcend the material conditions and remedy the root cause, you tend to make both worse.
Could you explain what the difference would be there between attend to the material conditions and focusing on the material conditions and what you just said? Because you said if you just focus on the material conditions, you might get to the root cause. But if you try to overcome the material conditions, I'm just not sure I understand the distinction.
I'll take education system as an example, right? So, you know, there is a sort of widely held notion now that one of the primary purposes of the American education system is to redress income inequality, poverty, to promote economic and social mobility, and to provide students with a civic education. I happen to think all of that's basically right and legitimate. But, you know, my wife was a public high school teacher in New York, and the effort for teachers like her, the sort of drive from the administration and from the, not even the immediate school administration, but from the sort of educational culture and the teaching colleges to focus on like addressing root social cause problems among students as a primary role of the teachers, for the idea that the teacher should become principally moral educators, that they should see the eradication of poverty, that they should see the, in particular, since of course, like poverty ultimately matters less to the people of this bent than moral injustices, that they should see the redress of moral injustices as an essential part of their role as teachers, led to an outcome which was both, I think, morally perverse and left students poorer and less able to compete because they had been robbed of the basic tools that they needed. So in a very straightforward sense, right, my wife was a math teacher and she had to spend like an inordinate amount of time on sort of social justice cause stuff that was coming from the administration, and specifically on restorative justice, which was not only a practice, but was also something she had to go to workshops for. And the desire to make the implementation of restorative justice one of her principal tasks as a teacher both created more disorder and injustice in the school because you couldn't deal with the problem kids. And it also meant that she couldn't teach math, which is what she was there to do. So by having anointed her as some sort of like priestly progressive whose job was to inculcate the correct moral values in the school and in the student body, you end up depriving these kids of a decent math education, which would have given them a leg up, while at the same time, right, giving them the notion that the bad kids can get away with whatever. Because of course, like the good students in her classes, even the decent students, you know, there's like 2 to 3 kids in any high school class who can hold the whole class hostage, right? We all know this from our experience in high school. And having been one of those kids at various points in my life, I understand there's nothing, you know, I came from a good family. I wasn't wanting for anything desperately, but I just couldn't, you know, it was some of it was hormonal, probably some of it was temperamental. Like I just wanted to make trouble. That was, you know, there was nothing you could have done to fix that because that was, you know, like the juice was that was the juice for me. Like I just wanted to make trouble.
And, but you grew out of that, didn't you, Jacob? You grew up out of that. You're not like that anymore.
eventually it took many years, and there was no moral education anyone could have provided to me. There was no math education anyone could have provided to me either that would have gotten through to me. I needed to be sort of disciplined and quarantined probably. You know, I wasn't a terrible kid. I wasn't lighting fires or anything, but I was a distraction. And so my wife was actively prevented from dealing with that sort of thing. And the social justice causes ate up a tremendous amount of her time. And so for all of these reasons, you know, you didn't end up providing students with either the sort of social or practical education that would have actually benefited them. You would have been better off focusing on the sort of strict materialist, like, what are the tools that will give these kids a leg up, make them competitive, and also, you know, not just competitive worker bees necessarily, but competitive as individuals. And they were doing the opposite of that.
But we'll make them intellectually curious, expand their worldview,
all give of them that.
More and, tools. Yeah.
Listen, and I just had a conversation with George Shalaba, right, about an essay he wrote in which he is arguing on behalf of what he calls the yeoman virtues, thrift, diligence. And, you know, this being Shalaba, he's writing about this from a sort of left social democratic perspective, Lash inspired left social democratic perspective. But, you know, the thing that makes those virtues worth inculcating is the outcomes they produce. And, you know, among other things, now you might argue for them in sort of intrinsic or whatever other terms, maybe even in metaphysical terms, if that's your inclination. But you could also argue for them only purely in sort of materialist or even utilitarian terms, for that matter. And you would recognize that, you know, promoting, for instance, like a sense of agency in high school students is something that will put them in better standing to be successful, curious, adaptive individuals in their lives.
So, okay, let's talk now finally, as we almost get to the end of this conversation, about what's happening in between Israel and Gaza. I think I have two or maybe three big questions for you. Let's see if I can remember what they are. I'm getting old, Jacob. I find myself thinking these thoughts and then they disappear on me. So the first one would just be, would you agree that the cause of the success of and the embrace of Hamas can be explained, that it is primarily the continued, let's call it, occupation, apartheid, open air prison approach to the treatment of Palestinians, the fact that Palestinians are second-class citizens within Israel? Do you think those facts explain the success of Hamas? That would be my question.
No, and the simplest piece of evidence, or the most compelling piece of evidence that I can present to show you that the success of Hamas, and I assume we're talking broadly both about the success of Hamas among Palestinians.
Yeah, politically also, within Gaza, and then also, I guess, militarily, to the degree that you can call what they're doing it successful, but go ahead.
Okay, well, let me just make a distinction then. So let me address first the popularity of Hamas with Gazans, and then we can talk about the popularity of Hamas with the international left, as it were, in relation to the same question you asked. Is the support for Hamas that we see among some prominent leftists in America and elsewhere a function of the brutality of the Israeli occupation or continued disenfranchisement of Palestinians? To start first with Gaza, I think that there's no question that the Gazans saw Hamas as a preferable alternative to the other choice that they had at the time when they made that choice, which they only got to make once, of course, since there's only been one election in Gaza in two decades. But they saw Gaza as a preferable alternative to the Palestinian Authority because they saw the Palestinian Authority both as corrupt, accommodationist, and also controlled by the United States and Israel to some extent. And so insofar as they saw Hamas as the preferable alternative to the PA, they saw Hamas as better able to deliver on their political aspirations. Now, I think that the attempt to sort of correlate that to Israeli occupation or in particular, since you listed a sort of broad and not tightly correlated list of, let's say, injustices. Mm-hmm. I don't think that holds up. For instance, you listed second class status of Palestinians inside of Israel, or Arab mm-hmm. Israeli citizens. First of all, I think that second class status is grossly misrepresented often, but let's even accept, and I would accept, that there are instances of significant second class status for Arab Israeli citizens of Israel. The support for Hamas is not correlated to the status of those citizens of Israel. In other words, you don't see the variation in expressions of support for Hamas as being driven by that as a factor. So the relative success of the Arab political party in Israel, the relative treatment of Arab Israeli citizens and Palestinians in Israel by different Israeli governments that have taken considerably different approaches, that have had very different political characteristics and political cultures, has not driven significant shifts in the opinion polling or the level of popular support that I've seen. I think that Hamas has established itself as a, authoritarian military sort of terror state force, has established itself as the only game in town, which makes it in some ways hard to evaluate it in terms of the kind of factors you're describing, which would drive shifts in support for Hamas that would be most readily or most apparent in, if not in polling, then in democratic processes that would register those shifts, in other words. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In some sense, it can be hard to measure just how much of the support is based on that. But if you look at what polling is available, I don't think, and if you look at the relationship between that polling and the independent factors that you described, I don't think that holds up. Now, let me give you another sort of concrete example. There was a recent poll conducted by a group, I believe, called it's Arab Research something. I'm sorry, I can look it up and maybe we can put in the notes or something. But it's a Palestinian group based in Ramallah. And they polled both Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. One of the questions they asked, and this was about 2 weeks ago, one of the questions they asked was, what do you see as the primary cause of the October 7th? I'm sure they called it attack, not massacre or whatever. But what was the primary cause of Hamas's operation on October 7th? And if you had to take a guess, Doug, what would you think the top response would be to that?
The settlements in the West Bank, which totally wrong, right? But that would be my knee-jerk left-wing.
I think that would be the knee-jerk response for a lot of people, not just on the left. No, it was the protection of Al-Aqsa, right? And why is this significant? First, it's significant, Al-Aqsa being the mosque in Jerusalem. The first reason why it's significant is because Al-Aqsa, the operation is named after Al-Aqsa. Mm. Al-Aqsa is not under any real threat. And most crucially in these terms, and by the way, I think it was somewhere between, it was either 33 or 35% of respondents listed that. So it was the plurality. The other reason why it's significant is that Al-Aqsa has been a pretext for violence, first against Jews, even before the state of Israel, and then for military operations, intifadas against Israel for 100 years. This is a century-old framework, reason, grievance, threat, paranoia, whatever you want to call it. Al-Aqsa is still standing, by the way. It's never been, demolished or occupied or desecrated in any sense so substantive that prayer couldn't return to it and, Muslim congregants couldn't return to it after. So Al-Aqsa is still standing. And yet this is the reason provided And it suggests that beyond the political grievances, beyond the, in some cases, very legitimate political claims, right? Like ending the occupation of the West Bank is a absolutely legitimate, just, necessary political claim, in my opinion. I think long-term military occupations are corrosive, unjust. It's unjust when the U.S. did it in Afghanistan. It's unjust when Israel does it in the West Bank. But of course, Gaza is no longer occupied. And Gaza hasn't been occupied since 2005 when Ariel Sharon unilaterally withdrew. There's an extensive sort of all hands on deck, full court press effort to explain why the end of the actual occupation in Gaza was not really the end of the occupation and didn't materially change anything for Gazans. And in fact, maybe it made things even worse. And when it was occupied, at least the Israelis were sort of close at hand, so you couldn't bomb Gaza indiscriminately. Like, there's any number of reasons provided, but all of these reasons sort of cluster around a reading of the situation that insists that the first order material facts on the ground are less important than the meta narrative. And so the end of the occupation can't really be the end of the occupation. It can't signal any kind of even marginal improvement. This is not to deny or minimize how difficult life is in Gaza for ordinary civilians. I think I might have a different sense of why that is than some listeners, but I would certainly not pretend that that's not the case. But there is a flattening of the sort of, on the one hand, a flattening of the actual conditions on the ground, such that any variation in those conditions, any material improvement, is never registered as a in political terms. And we can recognize this as somewhat similar from some of the kind of discourse around white supremacy in America around the 1619 Project as an implacable force. And, you know, so the condition of Black Americans in 2023 is not meaningfully different than it was under Jim Crow, even if the appearances have changed, right? This was an argument made by serious people. And there's a comparable argument being made now by serious people in relation to Palestine and Israel. And it's not a coincidence that in both cases, those arguments are buttressed by the exact same NGO sector, right? Like the Soros, Rockefeller, Tide Fund, Arabella Fund, dark money, progressive NGO sector is entirely backing this Palestinian maximalist, anti-Zionist reading of the situation that has a sort of ontological maximalism that was the same sort of ontological maximalism that we saw with Black Lives Matter and in a sort of discourse that, despite being totally unrelated in real political terms, is connected in discursive terms in part because it has the same elite NGO sector behind it. And I'm happy to elaborate on that more. I didn't get to why I think your analysis is wrong in relation to the Western left and its support for Hamas.
Well, go ahead if you'd like to say
okay.
that.
So, in that case, I think that the same argument is even clearer, right? The principle of support for the Palestinian cause.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.